With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. You're listening to Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Well, most of you have heard of an organization called Antifa. Some pronounce it Antifa. It's in the German, it's Antifa. And they are, of course, it stands for anti-fascists, of course, and they claim that they are anti-fascists. It's actually part of a larger organization, and that larger organization is the Global Anarchist Movement. In the United States, Antifa showed up a few years ago, breaking things and protesting anything and everything. You'd find them stirring people up for violent protests against on the behalf of Black Lives Matter. You'd find them stirring up protests and violent acts against governments and immigration. You'd find them pretty much anywhere there was a political issue in the United States. Now, recently, within the past year, we've seen them showing up, attempting to radicalize pro-abortion people in the United States. And they're using the cover of an organization called Jane's Revenge as one of their operative groups, and they are attempting to animate people since the Dobbs decision was handed down, and just before that, when the leaked draft decision on Dobbs had trickled out of the Supreme Court, they began to organize and make threats. And so today we're going to explore Antifa, what it is and what it does and who they are, who's funding it, with Kyle Scheidler, who is director and senior analyst for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism at the Center for Security Policy. He conducts research and analysis on domestic threats to the United States with an emphasis on doctrines which fuel terrorism and shape the variety of kinetic and non-kinetic threats to the United States. Mr. Scheidler also specializes in Islamist groups operating inside the United States, having spent over a decade researching and writing on their history, doctrine, and impact. Today, we welcome Mr. Scheidler as our expert witness on Through the Looking Glass. Mr. Scheidler, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with Antifa itself. When did they really show up in this current incarnation? Because they actually were showing up even before that as the anarchists showing up following the World Bank and protesting. And then they kind of became known as Antifa inside the United States. At what point in time did they show up in the United States under that guise?
Sure. So I think if you go back to the beginning, it's helpful to sort of trace this thread all the way through. And the earliest iteration of Antifa in the United States was actually something called Anti-Racist Action in the 1980s. And they were allegedly a group of subculture punk rock skinhead types who were interested in pushing out white supremacists from the punk rock culture scene. This is exactly the same way that Antifa emerged in Britain as well.
Well, hold on. Let me ask you a question. They were skinheads, but they were trying to push out the skinheads from the punk rock culture.
Yeah. So if you go back to the beginning of the formation of punk rock culture, you had punks and skins were not inherently seen as white supremacist or fascist or right wing. That is a connotation that we've developed today, but it wasn't traditionally the case. And it was actually a response to that growing impression that people were getting that you had this development. So really the first group in the United States that you might say would form the basis of Antifa was a group called the Baldies, out of Minneapolis, who were a punk rock skinhead multiracial group that fought with white supremacists in Minneapolis. They would go on to join anti-racist action throughout the Midwest, which would eventually become a nationwide concern. The interesting thing about that is during the formation of anti-racist action, you had present a group called the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. And this is really kind of the first example of quote-unquote anti-fascist action in the United States is the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. Now, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, which claimed to counter-protest Klan members and those sorts of things, was actually a front group for the May 19th Communist Organization, which was the last remnants of the Weather Underground that was committing armed robberies and bombings up to about 1983. So you have in the formation of anti-racist action the remnants of that 1960s, 1970s communist urban guerrilla movement and all of the techniques and the knowledge that were developed out of that violence of the 60s and 70s and sort of flows into the development of anti-racist action. Now, why is it called anti-racist action in the United States and it's called anti-fascist action in Britain and in Germany? Well, it's because in the U.S., people know what a racist is. And back then, they didn't really think about the term fascist. It didn't really resonate with people. So they used the term anti-racist action instead. But it's effectively the same concept, same people doing the same stuff.
So and the John Brown group is still around, isn't it? Going by the name of the John Brown Gun Club.
They are certainly harkening back to that. I don't think they are literally the same people. There are, in fact, people in Antifa today who are literally still from the days of the Weather Underground and who were Weathers of the Underground members. But they're few and far between, and they're sort of older, and they play sort of an advisory role these days, sort of an elder statesman type thing. But certainly they are making that ideological connection. Right. That is the goal there. And so you see references to John Brown travel throughout that thread from all the way from the Weather Underground through the May 19th Communist Organization and through to today.
The John Brown Gun Club, few people have even heard of it, but the John Brown Gun Club is a socialist militia is how they describe themselves. And many reports say that they have about 40,000 members nationwide. Comport with what you know about that organization?
40,000 seems awful optimistic to me. They do certainly have chapters across the country, and particularly in places where you wouldn't necessarily expect to see Antifa. Places like Texas, they've got strong chapters. Places in the Appalachians, in Tennessee, in North Carolina, they have strong chapters. The John Brown Gun Club is part of a larger strategy deliberately targeting rural working class people for recruitment, sort of because they know that rural working class people are pro-gun, believe in carrying arms, believe in the Second Amendment, et cetera. So they, if you go with sort of the traditional urban anarchist motif, it's not going to resonate. And so, so they're deliberately approaching it from sort of a different direction.
And some of those chapters are called, for example, the Redneck Revolt, and really doing just as you've described, appealing to people in the rural areas who are probably very proficient with the use of firearms. And they're, if I'm reading you correctly, they're bringing them in and kind of leeching into their own global worldview regards to socialism and trying to maybe perhaps recruit these guys into that worldview. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned in your intro their efforts to do outreach to pro-choice, the ties to the environmentalist movement. And in every case where you have these connections, they are trying to use what you and I would think of as policy questions. You know, what should the policy on X be? And we think of that as part of the natural democratic debate. But they are involving themselves in these questions because they are looking to draw in the more radical people who are willing to take action into their circle, into their milieu. So obviously there are many people in the United States who are pro-choice who are never going to firebomb a pregnancy resource center. But as people get animated about a given topic, some people get, you know, more and more animated, and that's the people they're looking for, to bring them in and saying, you know, you have all these things that you want in a democratic society, these policies, but you can't get them democratically. You can't get them fairly. You can't get them through the election process. We're going to get them in real life right now through what they call direct action. So we're going to live our experience the way we want to live it right now. And anybody who gets in our way, better watch out.
We're speaking with Kyle Scheidler from the Center for Security Policy on Through the Looking Glass, TNT Radio. And we are now, what we saw with Antifa activating this group calling itself Jane's Revenge, which was, there's been approximately 181 attacks on pro-life organizations, whether it be crisis pregnancy centers or Catholic churches or whatever the case may be, the very people that they see as those who are behind the movement to get Roe v. Wade overturned. But I would say my own analysis, they are not actually animated themselves by abortion, but they see an opportunity to animate others who are and make them part of their larger organization. Is that a reasonable assessment, Kyle?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly they are pro-abortion, I would say almost to a T, but it is sure. It is not their animating ideology. They are not a policy organization. They are not a one issue organization. They have a worldview and an ideology which includes many of these things or all of these things. And they are interested in bringing people into the totality of that ideology through whatever means necessary. There's also a tendency, especially within anarchist movements and ideology, they're anarchists, right? So people are going to do what they want to do. They're going to focus on what they want to focus on. So they can take advantage of whatever your personal interest is, whether it's the environment or whether it's pro-abortion stuff or whether it's police abolition stuff, whatever that policy of yours is that you're animated about, they want you to be active in that space. Go do the thing that you want to do. And they will support you and they will help you and they will show you tactics and methods and so on to do that. And all of those things are beneficial to them. But this name or a particular policy is part of the longstanding sort of urban guerrilla warfare strategy known as propaganda of the deed, right? So when they firebomb a pregnancy resource center or whether they vandalize a Catholic church, they want everything about that action to reflect back on what they want people to be focused on. So the name of the organization claiming responsibility, whether it's Jane's Revenge or what have you, they want it focused on what they want people to be focused on. So this is part of their media management strategy as well. And they can change the name all the time depending on what they want people to be focused on. So maybe one day they're forest defenders when they're, you know, fighting with cops in an Atlanta forest. And the next day they're Jane's Revenge when they're firebombing a pregnancy resource center. But it's really the same network of people. And they're just using the names to focus attention where they want it focused and to take the focus off of what they don't want it focused on.
We're speaking with Kyle Scheidler, the Center for Security Policy, about Antifa, the global anarchist movement, Jane's Revenge, and a whole series of organizations associated with radical left-wing extremists inside the United States. We're going to take a short time out. When we come back, I'll ask Mr. Scheidler, has Antifa been effective in radicalizing pro-abortion people and groups to its side in have they radicalized them in any way? We'll ask how effective they've been. Right now, we'll take a break. You're listening to TNT Radio's Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler in Washington, D.C. Stay tuned.
TNT Radio's Joe Hoft.
Hunter Biden needed some information for his Ukrainian buddies at Burisma, where he's making millions of dollars from. What he did is he reached out to a guy, and this guy was a former Homeland Security guy. And in 2015, Hunter went to him and got information on why these guys from Ukraine, his buddies, didn't get visas. This guy got the information for Hunter, which is classified. This is not information anybody can share. It went to Hunter. Hunter shared it with Burisma. So we've got our first instance, or second one, because last week Miranda Devine from New York Post raised one other email, which was like 22 points that Hunter Biden had written down that didn't make sense. It didn't look like it came from Hunter. These things look like a document from the State Department, which we found out they were. So there's document one. Last night we identified document two, Hunter Biden taking classified information, and he shared it and moved it on to his Burisma friends. So classified documents, to have them and you don't have a reason, that's called a crime.
Joe Hoff on today's News Talk, TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Here's what I wanted to add to that conversation.
The conversation continues.
They just mean well, but they can't do any better what they're doing.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler. Today we're speaking with Kyle Scheidler. He's our expert witness on Antifa and the growing, militant anti-American pro-socialist organization and its splinter groups. And going into the break, Mr. Scheidler, I said we would ask the question of how effective the Antifa group has been in animating people who are pro-abortion, but up to this point have been nonviolent. They've been vocal, but they have not destroyed anything. And then suddenly, when the Dobbs decision leaked, and then after the Dobbs decision was codified by the Supreme Court, we saw these firebombing of crisis pregnancy centers and attacks on pro-life organizations with graffiti saying, if abortion isn't safe, you're not going to be safe, and slogans like that. How effective has Antifa been in recruiting the pro-abortion people to join them in their violent crusade, would you say?
I think probably the people actually doing the violence are the same sorts of people who do the same sorts of activities across the spectrum. The issue I'm most concerned with is the level of support or tolerance that are being expressed through media and to a certain extent through politicians. We had examples of, members of Congress, even Hillary Clinton, openly supporting revolutionary communist groups under the guise of this pro-choice stuff. So, you may have seen, for example, throughout the Dobbs protests, people wearing these green colors, that were representative of this group rise up for abortion rights. It was Hillary Clinton even tweeted out a support for them. AOC, that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for some of your listeners who maybe don't follow it that closely, spoke at one of their rallies, et cetera. And these people were nothing more than a front for the Revolutionary Communist Party. And they provided most of the backbone structure for a lot of these protests and rallies. And that, unfortunately, is what you see time and time again. You see sort of mainstream or supposedly mainstream Democrats, people elected to Congress, significant media figures promoting and supporting front groups who are really representative of revolutionary groups, communist groups, anarchist groups, genuine radicals, because those people know how to take action. They know how to animate groups. They know how to conduct marches. They know how to conduct protests, etc. So if you're the Democrats and you want to make something a big issue, you need people in the streets. These are the people you go to. So to a certain extent, it's transactional. But you're also giving those people certain levels of respect. You're treating them as normal and mainstream. You are increasingly defending them when they are criticized publicly. You are attacking or criticizing the police when the police take action to deal with things like Antifa. We had the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, referring to federal law enforcement as Gestapo, others referring to them as stormtroopers, because they were trying to keep Antifa from burning down a federal courthouse. And so,
yeah, they were doing that until they needed the Capitol Police. They needed to turn the Capitol Police into heroes for the January 6th event. But including myself, have referred to Antifa as the Democrat Party militia because they seem to act. Now, I'm not saying they are acting in conjunction, but they seem to act in conjunction with the Democrat Party's interests by rioting based on having Trump as president and Democrats bailing him out of jail as they did in 2020. They seem to have this symbiotic relationship with the Democrat Party. Is that a reasonable assessment?
I think if you asked the average Antifa member, he would tell you a very popular graffiti slogan during the riots, which was "Liberals get the bullet too." Another one we saw on election night was "We don't want Joe Biden; we want revenge," or "Death to liberalism and or death to fascism and the liberalism that enables it." So the average Antifa member, the average anarchist movement member, the average revolutionary communist is going to tell you that these people, the Democrats, are his enemies. But
of course,
the opposite
that would
is
be
not true. But the opposite is not true. We don't see that from the Democrats. We see the Democrats posting pictures of the invasion of Normandy and saying this is Antifa, or, you know, calling police stormtroopers. So there is, and the media aggressively, you know, there was an article in Rolling Stone this week sort of aggressively promoting this guy who self-identified as Antifa. And so you have a lot of media that is supportive or in love with Antifa and using them for their own purposes, even though Antifa itself certainly doesn't have goodwill towards the Democrats. And indeed, their ultimate goal is to make all mainstream politics be perceived as fascist and push the mainstream left further and further left. That is part of their goal. So as they go, as people glom on to what they're doing, they're driving the main elements of the mainstream left further left and identifying people who are actually probably centrists or even sort of traditional Democrats, identifying them as fascists and right wings. So they're, if your audience is familiar with the term, the Overton window, the purpose of Antifa is to move the Overton window such that mainstream politics is no longer acceptable and is labeled fascist. And increasingly revolutionary politics is viewed as acceptable or permissible. And unfortunately, we see a lot of elements especially on the very progressive side of the Democratic Party, falling in line with that. And that is very disturbing, and it's very dangerous. But that is where we are. And that's why I focus on Antifa the way that I do, because the ability to achieve that political goal is far more dangerous than any particular act of violence. You know, security services focus on bombings and people who get killed and so on and so forth, and it makes sense that they do. But the real purpose of terrorism is to achieve a political objective. And from that perspective, Antifa is among the best, because they're excellent at the propaganda side. They're excellent at achieving the political objective.
We're speaking with Kyle Scheidler, the Center for Security Policy, about Antifa. And you said that the Antifa wants to overthrow, their nihilists. They want to kick over the entire establishment. But again, there seems to be a symbiotic relationship with the Democrat Party, even though they ultimately would, just like any other communist, would eventually rid themselves of their best allies. But for right now, the two seem to be working together, in that when the Democrats need chaos for something to achieve an objective, or to try and paint something as, like the police, as dangerous, they seem to be working to one another's benefit, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, here's the way I see that works. I don't really think that there's a direct, what we would call, command and control in
no,
the traditional sense that somebody sends a message. But what they can do is think of it as, they don't necessarily have control of the steering wheel, but they have control of the accelerator and the brake through control of media and through the flow of money and funding. So if they want more action from these groups, they can increase funding to things like bail funds and so on. If they want to focus their attention in a particular way, they can hype media on one topic or another. If they don't want action, they simply don't cover things. And so, because the function of Antifa is like a swarm, and the sort of the more stimulus you give it, the more interaction you get. So if they want something to blow up big, like the George Floyd situation, they can push in a lot of money and a lot of media attention, and things happen. If they want to reduce the level, they reduce the level of media coverage, they reduce the level of money, and these things, they're still happening. Antifa is active all the time. It's just a question of whether you're hearing about it, whether it's getting the media focus and the funding sort of support from these various fundraising structures. And so that is sort of their method of control, if you want to call it control.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's control. I think they feed off one another. The Democrats can send a message without, you know, no command and control structure at all. In fact, that's the hallmark of groups like Antifa. There is no command and control structure. They are individual cells acting in their own interests. But if you're the Democrat Party and you're bailing some of their thugs out of jail, you're sending a message. We're sympathetic. And when they defend them, like Gerald Nadler, the congressman from New York, did in 2020, and said they're not rioting, and their Democrat Party media allies in the press corps refer to them as nonviolent or mostly nonviolent protests, they're sending a message to keep going. They're pouring fuel on the fire. And of course, Antifa may in the back of their mind say they're the enemy too, but they're also going to use the enemy to achieve its objectives. And that's where it seems like we are at this point from a political standpoint. Now, the Democrats may regret feeding Antifa this way at some point in the future, but for now, they seem to be actually helping them, and for reasons that seem out of reach for the average person to comprehend. Why would violence in the street make people vote Democrat, especially while they're they're talking about defunding the police. It would seem like it would have the opposite effect. Do you see any, maybe this goes to the psychological area of voters' minds, but why would this seem to be happening, would you say?
Well, you know, I mentioned that Overton window, Scott, and the way that I believe that it works is if you support a fringe that is more radical than your position, that is more aggressive than your position, it makes you seem reasonable by comparison. So, for example, when people were talking about defunding the police during the George Floyd riots, that was not initially on the table. Nobody was talking about defunding the police. What they were talking about was, oh, isn't this terrible? Somebody should do an investigation, so on and so forth. And then we start to have the violence. And the Antifa types, the BLM types, what is their explicit message? It isn't defund. It's abolish the police. And then we start to see so-called moderates show up and they say, no, abolish is too strong. Abolish is a scary word. Defund. Let's defund the police. Let's reduce their level of influence. Let's reduce their funding. We're not going to abolish them. That's a little crazy, blah, blah, blah. But we are going to defund them. Right. So through the violence, you now make yourself with a radical position seem reasonable by comparison. And that is the political warfare play that I think is advantageous for a lot of the Democrats. You know, they'll say people are outraged about this. Obviously, we have to do something. We're not going to do anything crazy, but we're going to do more than we ever would have done if there hadn't been violence in the streets. Right. And so that's how it works. And this is really a political warfare strategy that operates across ideology. Whether you're jihadists cooperating with groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, or whether you're some kind of insurgency, think about Sinn Féin and the Irish Republican Army. And, you know, you always have some group that is out there in front of your actual position, so that your position becomes the political fallback position, and you then advance the ball, and the next time around, you take a slightly more radical position, a slightly more radical position. And so you are moving the country politically in the direction you want them to go. And they're still saying, well, these guys seem rational compared to the actual lunatics. So politically, the strategy there, is traditionally just one that works, full stop.
You know, you make your analysis of the bringing in the Islamists, for example. I happen to be working deep cover inside the Islamic resistance movement at the very moment we discovered that the Islamic resistance movement, of course, for the audience being Hamas, and which is a Sunni terrorist organization, at the very moment that Palestinian Islamic Jihad began working with Hamas, and Iran was funding both organizations. And no one in the intelligence community could believe it because they hadn't seen that before, that kind of joint operation. But in the minds of the terrorists, they saw an opportunity to advance their mutual objectives in this way. And it kind of seems like there's that unspoken agreement among Democrats and Antifa in the United States at this moment. Is that a fair comparison?
I think so. I mean, what you're really talking about is the performance of revolutionary politics, an age of revolutionary politics. And of course, if you go all the way back to the 1930s, that's where Antifa gets its start. And that's what its purpose is, right? Disrupt traditional ways of doing things, mainstream political access, and make everything politics of the street, revolutionary politics. And so you mentioned, you know, those strange allies. Even in the 1930s, Antifa's main enemy was not the Nazi Party. Their main enemy was the Social Democrat Party, which was sort of a center-left party, a socialist party. But their goal, again, was to force a choice between radicals. You can either be with us, the communists, or you can be with the Nazis. And we saw how that worked out for them in the 1930s. But that's the strategy today. And it plays the same way. to force a choice. You know, if President Trump is a fascist and mainstream center-right Republicans are fascists, and if even center-left people are fascists, then what's your choice, right? Your choice is between radicals. So come on and join the anti-fascist side. And that's the way that they play the
propaganda. Notice how Democrats began calling Republicans fascists. And it seemed to work. It seemed to work at that moment in terms of messaging. You have the anti-fascist militias out there, or calling themselves anti-fascists, and you have the Democrats calling their opposition fascists, and then they're bailing the anti-fascists out of jail for rioting. I mean, it was kind of a bizarre, you know, the landscape seemed very strange. We're coming up on a break. We've got Kyle Scheidler with us from the Center for Security Policy. We'll take a short time out when we get back. We're going to talk about the Revolutionary Communist Party of America and their possible connection to Antifa, and who is funding this. Mr. Scheidler mentioned the Weather Underground. Some of their elements are still around and part of Antifa. We'll explore that a little bit in our final segment. So stay with us. You're listening to Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler in Washington, D.C.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Don't miss the forest for the trees. The real story today isn't whether Alec Baldwin's Spanish wife, Elaria, is actually from Spain. Of course she isn't. She's Hillary Lynn Hardway Thomas from Weston, Massachusetts. She's as American as Alec is. And the real story of the day isn't whether Damar Hamlin was really at the Bills game. It was probably a body double. Maybe it wasn't. Who knows? Who cares? The real story of the day isn't even that Mike Pence rushed to Joe Biden's rescue in the document scandal by conveniently finding some classified documents in his own house. Funny that he didn't rush to President Trump's defense, finding documents in his own house. No, the real story of the day is the absolute clown world that we're told to believe in, that anybody with half an ounce of common sense knows is completely false. But that's the Democrat Party today. Up is down, left is right, and right is wrong. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Are you finding it harder to do the things you used to do, like vacuuming or getting to appointments? If you need a bit of support at home, the Australian Government's My Aged Care is your starting point to access services. You'll find all the information and advice you need in the one place. To find out about other services, eligibility and costs, call 1800 200 422 or go to myagedcare.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra, spoken by Heather Christie.
Tracking global corruption and threats that undermine our security.
Through the Looking Glass.
This is Through the Looking Glass with Scott Wheeler on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler in Washington, D.C. Our expert witness today is Kyle Scheidler. He is with the Center for Security Policy and is an expert on domestic and foreign terrorist organizations. Mr. Scheidler, going into the break, I mentioned, referenced one of your earlier remarks about some of the Weather Underground, a 60s terrorist group, domestic terrorist group. Many remember the name of Bill Ayers, who became his wife, Bernadine Dorn, who became famous because they were friends with Barack Obama in 2008. And you mentioned that some of these Weather Underground members are still around and they're involved with Antifa. What I noticed in my own investigations of Antifa was communications of almost professorial communications, very high level of language, diction, usage with some historical context. Is that why Antifa seems like a high-end intellect-run organization, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, they have all, it takes all types. So they do have genuine street thugs, and homeless people and people with a little bit of mental illness. But they also have a lot of professors and a lot of grad students and people who are, you know, very intellectually aware, very capable. They are a people who understand their own history. They are almost obsessive about going through the history of left-wing revolutionary violence. They have their heroes. They have their villains. But they understand what has worked in the past, what has not worked. You know, you mentioned Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn actually appeared at an anti-racist action conference. I think it was in 2010. It was a couple years ago. But so they do have these intellectual relationships. They've never, you know, these guys have never denounced or renounced any of their behavior. You know, I think Bill Ayers was quoted as saying he wished he had done more, you know, these kinds of things. Their only objections were tactical. What they have said to the modern day Antifa is learn from what we have done wrong. Learn from what we did wrong. And one of those things that they note that they did wrong was not successfully controlling the level of violence. They conducted bombings. Sometimes people were killed, and that created a level of resistance to what they were trying to do. So they say you have to keep the level of violence at a tolerable level. One that the state will accept and will tolerate without cracking down and crushing you, but it, which is high enough to impose a cost upon your opponents. So that's why, for the most part, we see limited, you know, killings and bombings, but we see firebombings, Molotov cocktails, physical melee violence, the destruction of property. There has been a rash of targeting of police property, particularly police cars. Police will park their cars in lots, you know, outside the police department, and somebody will come along and Molotov cocktail a bunch of them, burning up the vehicles. Targeting things, not people, is an important part of their tactical purpose. And again, it's not because they're nice people, and it's not because they're not willing to hurt you, and it's not because they're not willing to kill you. It's because tactically it is not to their advantage. So they have these, you know, structures and organizational concepts that go all the way back to the Spanish Civil War, and they're constantly refining them and thinking about what works and what doesn't work. They're iterative. They try something. If it doesn't work, they try something else. They learn a lesson. And that is one of the reasons, again, that I think that they are far more significant and capable than other threats, because they learn. They learn from what they do right and what they do wrong. And they constantly are shifting tactics depending on the situation. So in 2020, large riots made sense. They had a topic, George Floyd, that everybody was focused on, that had the national attention. And they had a cohort of people that were enraged, you know, in the urban situation, that they could call upon, people who were active, who were angry, that they could hide among. When those riots started to die down, they started to shift targets. They started to shift to more small cell direct action, targeting police cars with Molotov cocktails, like I said, targeting these pregnancy resource centers, conducting small scale actions outside of these drag queen story hours and shows, those kinds of things to keep themselves active, keep themselves in the news. But they've shifted tactics slightly depending on the situation, which again goes back, you mentioned the Weather Underground, goes back to the Weather Underground. In 1969, the Weather Underground tried that strategy of riots. There was the massive rioting outside of the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And what ended up happening was the police cracked down really hard. A bunch of them got charges put on them. They had really high bail. And they went underground and they started doing these bombings and conducting other actions that were not so public and not so easily disrupted. So they are constantly learning, and they're constantly shifting their tactics over time. And my concern has been, after the riots of 2020, that they would take what they learned from there, they would take the recruits that they earned, because they had all this attention on them, and funnel those people into smaller and more dangerous direct actions. And I think we're seeing some of that now.
We're speaking with Kyle Scheidler, the Center for Security Policy. What is the Revolutionary Communist Party USA, and does it have a connection with Antifa?
They do. So the Revolutionary Communist Party is founded by a guy named Bob Avakian, who was a Maoist and a member of the Students for a Democratic Society. That was the larger group that eventually would give birth to the Weather Underground. When the Weather Underground seizes control of the Students for a Democratic Society in the late 1960s, they push out all of these other communists, all of these other revolutionary types to take over. So Bob Avakian
they were kind of split between the pro-Soviet and the pro-China models of the Maoist communist model versus the Soviet, the Stalinist model of communism, and they split up. But what's their current relationship with Antifa? What is is there a connection there, and what's the extent of it?
The last I have seen, there's actually a great deal of hostility between anarchist and autonomous Marxists and what they would derogatorily call tankies, meaning pro-Stalinist, pro-Maoist type groups, of which Revolutionary Communist Party is one. So we have actually seen cases where Antifa groups have disrupted Revolutionary Communist Party marches. They've tried to take over those marches. They've thrown their banners in the river. There's been a lot of conflict with them. Similarly, a lot of conflict with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, which is another one of these revolutionary communist groups. And so this is the sort of the not uncommon conflict between anarchists and communists that you see during any of these periods. They can unite and cooperate when they have a common enemy and there's a common focus. You know, when Trump is in office, there's a great deal of cooperation. They can agree on a lot of points. But when things relax a little bit, then they start infighting. And we're in a period, I think, right now of infighting between the two groups. But they still rely on each other. You know, the Revolutionary Communist Party is able to put together marches and rallies, and they have front groups that they can use publicly that can can get attention, can get media. And Antifa will glom onto those protests and use violence or conduct vandalism. That vandalism in turn draws media attention to the rally, which the Revolutionary Communist Party was having. And so it draws attention to them, which they like. So again, it's one of these things where on the surface, they are certainly political opponents, but they cooperate and they fight at the same time. And so it's very traditional to see that, and people
so again,
see
kind
something
of,
like
kind
that
of,
in a movement, and they think, well, this is all different groups, and nobody's really in charge, and this is just a big morass. But the reality is, it's a mass movement, right? It's a mass movement, and mass movement politics requires all of these different little splinter groups to move the ball forward in different ways. And even though they don't agree with each other, they are all advancing the cause together. And so it's a competitive but cooperative environment.
Again, similar to the Sunni and the Shia working together. And at the time, there was a lot of bitter enmity between the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, especially. They did not want to work with Hamas eventually they did. Their pressure from Iran pushed them into it. And so similar here, you've got these revolutionary groups all saying, even though we disagree with one another, we have a common enemy, and that common enemy is the United States. Where would you say Antifa gets its funding? Now, they don't necessarily need a lot of funding because their activities don't require a lot of armaments or anything like that. It's all basically handmade explosives and things like that. But Who funds them, would you say? What funding they need?
They are primarily self-funded, crowdsourced funded. They will have a variety of front groups that take aid or incorporate aid. Or sometimes they'll even publicly just say, hey, we're Antifa, please give us money. A lot of it is even individuals who will say, I am an Antifa member. I need money for a new bulletproof vest. Give me $300. And people will give them $5, $10, $50, whatever, until they raise the money that they need. Their big expenses are things like bail fund and transportation. And these things are often paid by larger groups, groups like BLM or these other protest groups that obviously have an interest in, you know, conducting a protest or an action to which then, as I said, Antifa can glom on. So they can participate in that action, get the benefits of that funding, even though it's not money that goes directly to them, it is still of use to them. So like your really big money is that kind of bail funds and those kinds of things. And that's where some of that comes from. But most of it is self-funded, crowdfunded. It does travel across international lines. They have an Antifa International Defense Fund that has funded anarchists and over 200 anarchists and Antifa members in like 53 countries or something. Maybe that number is a little high, but something like that. So they do move money across international borders, which is legally significant, although it's not something that our law enforcement agencies have paid much attention to. But most, for the most part, as you said, it's not terribly expensive to do the kinds of things that they do.
One of the things I observed at the ground level was you would seem, where you had a protest, you would have a lot of local young college students on the streets, and then you'd have a couple of people from somewhere else in the country seeming to be the organizers, kind of directing the activities. What is that about?
Yeah, Antifa is very much a traveling show. And as I said earlier, they do rely on these larger crowds, and that's why they need to be able to focus on issues that will bring people out into the street that they can then hide among. But I have personally observed leaders of protests in Washington, D.C., who have openly said, I am from Portland, meaning, you know, Antifa-like, and Rose City, this is not Antifa, how we do it in Portland. You guys are all jacked up. Let me show you how it's done, right? So they if you think of it as those cells moving around, training, recruiting other cells, bringing people in to support them, creating support structures, networks that can then go out and do likewise. That's pretty much right. You know, you've got a couple of strong nodes in places like the Pacific Northwest where they've got a lot of pull, and then they can go out and they can support other groups. They have an ethic of what they would say is in anti-fascist organizing, where they go, we go. So if they hear reports of something that they consider fascism, they're going to go. They're going to go respond to it, and they're going to go try to stop it in their minds. So it's not uncommon to have a situation like we had in Atlanta, where they have charged almost a dozen people with domestic terrorism for a variety of felonies. And a large number of those people were from out of state. They were not from Georgia. They came from Pittsburgh. They came from, you know, all across.
Yeah,
the
six people who were arrested by the Atlanta Police Department were, I believe, all were from out of state. Mm-hmm. And so it is a traveling show, as you described it. We're wrapping up here the hour with Kyle Scheidler, who is who's with the Center for Security Policy, an expert witness in terrorism, domestic terrorism, and international Islamist terrorism. Mr. Scheidler, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that is the beginning of what we're going to have more of in the way of Antifa and the globalist anarchist movement in general. We'll have more as our investigations unfold. We'll have more people like Mr. Scheidler joining us here on Through the Looking Glass to make the case so that people can evaluate who the enemy is. And we saw over the previous 2 years, we've seen Antifa came on everybody's radar screen all at once. And there was this great awakening sort of to their existence, even though they've been there, as Mr. Scheidler described, for a long time. Thank you all for joining us on Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. on the great TNT Radio Network.